It's Hanukkah Lights from NPR. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Murray Horwitz. Since 1990, Susan and I have celebrated the Jewish Festival of Lights by reading more than 100 different Hanukkah stories.
Wow, that's a lot of stories, Murray.
And a lot of fun for us, Susan.
Well, with so many choices, this year we decided to replay some of our favorites, like this one, Hanukkah Gelt. Gelt means money in Yiddish, and it's by the great Yiddish writer Sholem Aleichem.
Take a guess, children. Which holiday is better than all the other holidays? Hanukkah! Sure, you don't go to school for 8 days in a row, you eat pancakes with applesauce, play your dreidel, and from all sides, Hanukkah gelt, money, comes pouring in. What holiday could be better than that? Winter. Outside it's cold, a bitter frost. The windows are frozen over, decorated with beautiful designs, the sills piled high with snow. Inside the house, it's warm and cheerful. The menorah stands ready on the table, and my father is walking back and forth, his hands behind his back, saying the evening prayers. When he is almost through, he takes out of the chest a candle, the shamas, to light the others with, and after the last prayer in the regular service, begins the Hanukkah blessings.
These lights we kindle,
my father continues, marching up and down the room with an eye on the Hanukkah lamp. He keeps up this chant till we grow impatient and wish that he would reach his hand into his pocket and take out his wallet. Muttle, I say to my brother, go ask him for Hanukkah money.
What? Why me?
Because you're younger, that's why.
You've got it backwards. You're older, you ask him.
My father is completely aware of what we're talking about, but he pretends not to hear. Quietly, slowly, he walks over to the cupboard and begins to count out some money. A cold shiver runs down our backs. Our hands shake. Our hearts pound. My father coughs.
Children, come here.
Huh? What is it?
Here's Hanukkah money for you.
The money in our pockets, we move off, at first slowly, then faster and faster, and finally we lose all restraint and turn three somersaults one after the other. In bed that night, I lie awake and think, how much would I be worth if all my uncles and aunts and other relatives gave me Hanukkah gelt? First of all, there's rich Uncle Moshe Aron, my mother's brother. Stingy, but rich. Then Uncle Itzi and Aunt Vera. Then Uncle Banish and Aunt Yenta. And how about our sister Ida and her husband Shalom Zadel and all the other relatives? Muttle, are you asleep?
Yes. What do you want?
How much Hanukkah money do you think Uncle Moshe Aron will give us?
How should I know? What am I, a prophet?
A minute later. Muttle, are you sleeping?
Of course.
So if you're sleeping, how can you talk to me?
You keep bothering me, so I have to answer.
3 minutes later. Muttle, are you awake? I sit up in bed, take out my father's present, smooth it out, examine it. A whole ruble. The next morning, after we have said our prayers and eaten breakfast, our mother puts on our fur-lined jackets and bundles us up in warm shawls, and we start off for our Hanukkah gelt. First of all, naturally, we stop off at Uncle Moshe Aron's. Our rich uncle, Moshe Aron, is a sickly man. He has trouble with his bowels. Whenever we come, we find him at the washbowl after having come in from the backyard, washing and drying his hands with the appropriate prayer. Good morning, Uncle Moshe Aron, we cry out together, my brother and I. Our Aunt Pessel, a tiny woman with one black eyebrow and one white one, comes forward to meet us. She shakes off our coats, unwinds our shawls, and proceeds to blow our noses into our apron.
Blow, says Aunt Pessel. Blow hard. Don't be afraid again. Again, that's the way.
And Uncle Moshe Aron, a little man with a moth-eaten mustache and ears stuffed with cotton, stands at the water bowl, wiping his hands, wrinkling his face, blinking at us with his eyes while he groans out his prayer.
Hey, Moshe Aron, we ought to give the children some Hanukkah money.
Uncle Moshe Aron doesn't hear. He keeps on drying his hands. Aunt Pessel repeats,
Moshe Aron, the children, Hanukkah gelt.
Oh, what?
Says Uncle Moshe Aron, and shifts the cotton from one ear to the other.
The children, Hanukkah gelt,
Aunt Pessel shouts right into his ear.
Oh, my bowels, groans Uncle Moshe Aharon.
That's the way he always talks, holding his belly with both hands.
Did you say Hanukkah money? What do children need money for? What will you do with it, huh? Spend it? Squander it? How much did your father give you, huh? Tell me.
He gave me a ruble, I say, and my brother a half.
A ruble? Some people spoil their children, ruin them.
Uncle Moshe Aharon shuffles off to his room and begins to search through all the chests and drawers. He finds a coin here, a coin there, and mutters to himself,
they spoil their children, ruin them, simply ruin them.
And coming back, he pushes a few hard coins into our hands. Once more, for the last time, Aunt Pessel blows our noses, puts our coats on, wraps the shawls around us, and we go on our way. Our second stop for Hanukkah Geld is at Uncle Itzi's and Aunt Dvera's, with whom my parents have not been on speaking terms for many years. Why they don't speak to each other? I don't know. But I do know that they never speak, although they go to the same synagogue and sit next to each other on the same bench. And yet, whenever there's a celebration in the family, a birth, a bar mitzvah, an engagement party, a wedding, the feud is forgotten. We all attend, exchange gifts, make merry, drink together, and dance together like the best of friends.
Good morning, Uncle Itzi. Good morning, Aunt Vero.
We cry out together, my brother Muttle and I, and they receive us like honored guests.
Did you come all this way just to see us, or was there something else on your mind, Uncle Itzi asks,
and pinches our cheeks. He opens his wallet and gives us our Hanukkah money, a new silver 20 kopeck piece to me and another one to my brother. And from there, we go straight to Uncle Banish's, who gives us 2 silver pieces each. Then we go to our sister Ida's. Since she was a child, Ida has always been a lugubrious creature. No matter what silly little thing happened, she could always be counted on to burst out crying. But when she became engaged to Shalom Zedel, that was when she really cried. No, not because the young man didn't please her, God forbid. She had never even seen the man. No, she wept because a bride is supposed to weep before her wedding. Well, when we come into the house, Shalom Zedel greets us.
Well, well, look who's here. I'm glad you came. I've been waiting, and I have some Hanukkah money for you.
And Shalom Zedel takes out his wallet and hands each one of us several shiny silver coins. And before we can even count how many he's given us, his hand flies out, smick, smack, slap across the face.
Leave them alone. Haven't you tortured them enough?
Our sister Ida begs him with tears in her eyes, and calling us aside, gives us a little more Hanukkah geld. We make our escape as quickly as we can and hurry home.
Well, Muttle, I say, let's get down to business. Let's figure out how much money we've collected.
And we count, and we count, and we count, and we can't get the total. We figure, and we figure, and we can't get it straight, because every time we come to our rich Uncle Moshe Aharon's old piatkes, giant 6 kopeck pieces, and smoothly rubbed 3s, we get so mixed up we don't know where we are. It turns out that these are coins that were from 3 governments ago, from before the flood. We try to exchange them with our mother, our father, with Brina the cook, but it doesn't work. Nobody wants to have anything to do with them.
What sort of piatkes are those? Who palmed them off on you?
We're ashamed to tell, and we keep quiet.
You know what, says my brother Muttle? Let's throw them into the oven, or outside in the snow when no one is looking.
Real smart, I tell him. It would be better to give them to a beggar. But just to spite us, no beggar comes to our door. Can you imagine? It's Hanukkah, and no beggars. Where are all the beggars? Ragged, hungry, crying for help. Not a soul. Not a single beggar. We can't even give it away. I'm telling you, it really pays to have a rich uncle.
Hanukkah Geld by writer and humorist Sholem Aleichem, a champion of the Yiddish language. His stories sang and danced their way to Broadway in the adaptation Fiddler on the Roof.
Our next story first broadcast in 1994. Here is Gifts of the Last Night by Rebecca Goldstein.
That the winds had taken possession of Manhattan on this last night of Hanukkah. That they were roaming the wide avenues, snarling and hissing like a pack of demons unloosed from Gehenna. This was not the way she would ever have described the situation. Pearl Pinsky had little use for metaphor, and none at all for old-world hocus-pocus. The simple facts. It was late December, early dusk, and cold. Damned cold. Devilishly cold. Those winds. Pearl had been waiting for almost an hour at her bus stop, not far from Columbia University. Classes were suspended for the winter recess, and the neighborhood felt eerily emptied. She stood at this corner all by herself as the savage evening deepened around her into demented night. Her eyes, streaming cruelly from the cold behind her bifocals, were the lone eyes fixed on the dimming west, from where she expected momentarily to see those bright headbeams rounding the corner from Riverside Drive. Meanwhile, it only got darker, and the imps of the air were whooping it up with the ends of the long woolen scarf Pearl was vainly attempting to keep wound across her face, breathing open-mouthed into the fuzzy wool to generate some warmth. It was an incongruous scarf to be seen on a middle-aged woman of an otherwise serious cast. Splattered with primary colors, it was like something a little child might have worn, or perhaps even have painted. This was a woman who gave little thought to appearances. At exactly the point at which she had even despaired of finding a taxi on this lonely stretch of Broadway, abandoned to godless gusts, at just that moment she turned and noticed a little plain restaurant. Nothing fancy, nothing trendy. To say it was modest is already to overdo it. Not a glance of the brilliance of the festive season fell upon it. Not a single colored light bulb glimmered. Not a glitter of a word had been hung to wish a patron or a passerby a merry this or a happy the other. Squeezed in, as it was, between the corner and a dazzlingly done-up Gap store glowing with a white star and a sentimental message, a person might almost not have noticed it at all. But Pearl had noticed. The winds themselves had taken hold and almost lifted her bodily from the pavement. She was, after all, not so much to lift. A short woman, full-figured, but still not weighing more than maybe 115 pounds, and had ungently nudged her through the door, slamming it shut behind her, so that all again was calm within the ill-lit establishment, where a lone customer sat eating his applesauce. He looked up, his spoon poised on its way to his open mouth, and stared intently at the bedraggled female suddenly brought before his gaze. The intellectual high forehead, black-framed glasses, and slightly sagging jowls, the bulging book satchel, incongruous scarf, and unraveling skirt drooping from beneath her coat. He took note of all the telling details, but of the scarf most of all. He was a writer. Her age he guessed exactly. It was what she looked, and a woman who wore such a scarf would have taken no pains to disguise the truth. Years ago, when the writer had been a man in all his vigor, he used to feel a certain mild outrage with such a woman as this, who took so little care to acknowledge and augment the feminine principle within her. This had been a great theme for him, both in his work and in his life, namely, the feminine principle. With him, it had never simply been a matter of a love affair, of which he had had a not insignificant number. Rather, it had been more a matter of paying homage to the feminine principle, wherever he had happened to find it realized and available in this or that particular lady of his acquaintance. He had been born to a woman who had known, even while he had not yet vacated her womb, that her firstborn would be a boy child of remarkable genius, destined to transform, at the least, the century. Nothing in his childhood had dimmed his mother's certainty, which had quite naturally been duplicated in him. The consequence was that he had been the sort of a man who couldn't feel the insistent urgings of his manhood without at the same time endowing them with universal themes and erecting them into a theory of art and of life. The exact details of this theory we can forget because even the writer had by now forgotten them. They had gone the way of the urgings, so that now he could examine this woman with nothing of his old outrage. All evening long, he had been aquiver with anticipation, since tonight was the very last night of Hanukkah, and he could not suppress his sense that the universe was not altogether indifferent. It had been the tradition when he had been a boy that each successive night of Hanukkah, his presents from his parents had gotten progressively more wonderful, a practice grounded in sound theology. After all, the ancient miracle of the little holy lamp that had continued to burn on such meager fuel, this miracle had gotten better and better with each passing day. The presents that it had been his to receive on those last nights of the magical Hanukkahs of his childhood, these he could recall in loving detail until this day. When he had been 5 years old, he had received a tiny violin, sized just right for his little cheek and shoulder. When he had been 6, it had been the entire set of the Book of Knowledge encyclopedias, all of whose 25 volumes with appendix he had read by the time he was 8. In fact, it had been of his beloved Book of Knowledge, with its many magnificent pages of full-colored plates, that he had only now been thinking when the restaurant door was flung open and his attention diverted. So that when Pearl Pinsky returned her defogged bifocals to the bridge of her nose, not a bad nose, he had noted, though a little wide, she found an old man's watery, red-rimmed eyes avidly fixed upon her. By this time the writer knew what he knew, and he closed his mouth around a smile as if he and this woman were on old familiar terms with one another. "Do I know you?" asked Pearl. "Such winds," responded the writer with a sympathetic little shiver, "snarling and hissing like a pack of demons unloosed from Gehenna." "Gehenna," the woman gave a short little hoot of a laugh. She had a high-pitched voice, more girlishly sweet than he would have anticipated, with just a hint of the plaintive to curdle it. Without any ceremony, she came over and sat herself down opposite the writer at his little formica table against the wall. "Gehenna," she repeated as she placed her book bag on the floor between her feet. "I thought it was supposed to be hot in Gehenna." "You thought wrong," the writer answered. Pearl was inclined to hoot once again, but she only snorted, and rather gently at that. The man across from her, palsied and bent, with only his imperious nose and vivid eyes still undiminished, was about the same age that her own father would have been, although her father would have had even less use than she for the quaint choice in metaphor just voiced. Simon Pinsky had been all sorts of things in his lifetime, including the editor of a Jewish anarchist newspaper, which had had its heyday when Pearl had been a child. She and her anarchist father had been comrades till the end, and Pearl had always felt most comfortable with men of Simon's generation. "You know, it's a funny thing," she confided after she had given her order for tomato soup to the young waitress. "I wait at this corner almost every evening for my bus, and I never once noticed this restaurant." "You're probably preoccupied. You strike me as a very preoccupied person." He stared at her for some moments more. "I wonder," he began slowly, "I wonder if you even realize what tonight is." She looked at him blankly. "It's the 8th night of Hanukkah, the very last night, the best night." He finished on a high note, almost a squeak. A spray of spittle punctuated his excitement. "Well, you're right there," Pearl answered, frankly taken aback. The old man was leaning toward her, his striped tie in his applesauce, his eyes protuberant to begin with, gazing into hers with strange meaning. "I mean, you're right that I wasn't aware." "I knew it. I knew you had forgotten." "It doesn't mean all that much to me." "You think you have to tell me that? You think I can't figure that out for myself?" he demanded in an aggrieved tone. He sat back in a sulk. "So why is the last night the best night?" Pearl asked him. Her father had also had a quirky temper, as had many of the men of his generation whom Pearl had known, so she was an old pro when it came to this kind of appeasement. "I never heard that one," she threw in for good measure. He didn't want to admit to her that the source of his pronouncement was only the order in which he had received his Hanukkah presents as a boy. She was clearly a very intelligent woman. He wouldn't be surprised to learn that she was a lady professor. But still, she was also, just as clearly, a person completely ignorant on the subject of Jewishness, so that he could lie to her if he wanted, which he did want. "It's part of the religion," he said, and took another spoonful of his applesauce. So if this is the best night, you should at least have some potato latkes to go with that applesauce, she said, smiling so girlishly sweet that he immediately repented. You know what, miss? Pearl, said Pearl. Pearl, I have a little something for you. He reached down into his pants pocket, fumbling around until he pulled out a little black book and handed it across the table to her. It was cheap imitation black leather, embossed with gold Hebrew letters. "It's a Jewish calendar," he said, smiling with the sudden pleasure of his own generosity. "Organizations are always sending them to me, whether I send them back a donation or not. This one happens to be the nicest, but I have others. Take it. It's hardly even used. One or two appointments I had in September, I penciled them in, but I'm not so much in demand as I used to be. It's almost as good as new, Pearl. And all the Jewish holidays they've got printed up, even the exact moment of the sunset when they start. This way, you'll at least know when you're not observing." "Well, thank you," Pearl said, her voice gone more girlish than ever. "Will you inscribe it for me?" "With pleasure." He was, after all, a writer. It wasn't the first time in his life his autograph had been shyly requested. Women, young and old, married and single, used to flock when he had given readings, and then they would line up afterwards to have him sign copies of his stories that they had clipped out from the Jewish newspapers. Pearl began to fish around in her purse for something to write with, but he quickly produced his own beautiful silver fountain pen, a gift he had received many years ago from one of his wealthier girlfriends. "Hanukkah 1994," Pearl read. "With my best wishes on the last night, I am Feigenbaum." Pearl looked up, her intelligent high forehead creased into wondering disbelief, her bifocals slipping down to the very tip of her short, wide nose. "I am Feigenbaum? Are you the I am Feigenbaum? I am Feigenbaum, the writer?" "You know me?" the writer whispered, barely able to control his quivering voice. "You know me?" Did Pearl Pinsky know I am Feigenbaum? And how she knew I am Feigenbaum. His brief heyday had coincided with the brief heyday of her father's paper, and sometimes Simon would receive a manuscript of a short story from the young author. Pearl's father had detested the writer I am Feigenbaum. It was not simply that this upstart was a sentimental bourgeois whose writing did not even acknowledge the great class struggles of the day. It was far worse. His stories wallowed in superstition and obscenity, unnatural lusts alternating with old-world hocus-pocus, and Simon Pinsky had regarded each and every page from the pen of I. M. Feigenbaum as a profound and personal insult. "Don't defile our trash cans with it," Simon Pinsky would command his wife, who helped out with the editing. "Our garbage is too good to be associated with it. Flush it down the toilet, Hannah." Simon Pinsky, as radical as he had been in his politics, had also had an almost rabbinical aversion to vulgarity. To hear him utter such a word as toilet was painful for his wife and daughter. A secret. Hannah Pinsky, an otherwise dutiful wife, had saved each and every one of those rejected manuscripts. In any case, such was the effect that the writer I. M. Feigenbaum used to have on Simon Pinsky. Pearl's was a forthrightly truthful personality. When she knew something, her procedure was to come right out and say it. It was in her nature, therefore, to explain precisely how it was that she came to know so well the name of I. M. Feigenbaum. But for once in her life, she held her tongue. Staring across the little formica table at the trembling old man whose face was luminous with the wonder of this extravagant gift, Pearl Pinsky blessedly held her tongue.
Gifts of the Last Night by Rebecca Goldstein. She's a professor of philosophy and a novelist, the author of 10 books, both fiction and nonfiction, she was awarded the National Medal of the Humanities by President Obama.
You're listening to Hanukkah Lights, Stories of the Season. Coming up, more holiday favorites you don't want to miss. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Murray Horwitz. You can hear this program again and explore more holiday programs on our website, npr.org. We'll be right back with more Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Welcome back to Hanukkah Lights. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Murray Horwitz. Our next story is How to Spell the Name of God by Ellen Orleans.
Hanukkah's early this year, my mother said, mostly to herself. She stood on a step stool, unearthing the menorah from our kitchen pantry. My brother pounced.
Actually,
he told her, voice slightly nasal,
it isn't. Statistically speaking, December 12th is neither early nor late. For example, 5 years ago, Hanukkah started on December 7th. In 1969, December 4th.
Jonathan had recently acquired a perpetual Jewish calendar and was obsessed by it. He claimed he had a photographic memory, and maybe he did. He had memorized his Haftorah portion in under a week. But for all his boasting, my older brother sure couldn't remember that one thing my parents told him over and over. Nobody likes a know-it-all. Mom looked at Jonathan, shook her head, and smiled. She set the menorah in a tinfoil roasting pan and slid it into the oven. Soon, the sweet smell of warm wax filled the kitchen. My brother liked numbers. I liked words. Countenance, crepuscular, and now perpetual. In Hebrew school, we were learning different words, different names for God.
El Elyon.
Meant God Most High. Was there a least high God?
Elohim.
Meant mighty ones, which was no surprise, except it was plural. The rabbi said this multiplied God's power.
Hashem.
Meant the name, which was confusing in a trippy sort of way. His name is the name. I expected my classmates to have 100 questions about God's names, but they didn't. What did they care about? Not who is God or what is the nature of God, but how do you spell God? We argued if it should be G-D or G-D or maybe just G-D. Was one abbreviation better than another? Did the hyphen mean something that the little star didn't? Could you put an ampersand in the middle, or was that pagan? How about a dollar sign? Was that anti-Semitic? Could Jews be anti-Semitic? What we did know was that the three letters, G-O-D, must never be spelled out. If they are, then that piece of paper can never be thrown in the trash. It is sacred. Which is exactly why Baruch Benson, Bobby Benson in real life, during the final minutes of Monday afternoon Hebrew school, wrote G-O-D, all caps, all three letters, on a sheet of notebook paper, then shoved it into Kenny Growlick's back pocket.
Have to keep it forever,
he sing-songed as the bell clattered. In the hall, Kenny yelled,
Glenn, you're it!
And slapped the God paper into Glenn's hand, where it stayed until Glenn passed it to Shimon, who was always off in dreamland, until Cheryl, thinking it was something else, grabbed it, giggled, and pushed it off onto Debbie. By then, we were in the parking lot, shivering, waiting for our carpools home. Before running into the sea of idling cars, Debbie passed the damp folded, unfolded, refolded note to Nurit, who was new and didn't get the game. That's when I took it, because unlike all of them, I knew how to handle the name of God. You bury the name of God.
God was still in my pocket as we sat down to supper. Jonathan dove back in.
Hanukkah this year is also not early compared to 1980, when it will begin December 2nd, or 1991, when it starts December 1st.
He paused to push his hair out of his eyes, and then he repeated,
1991, a numeric palindrome.
As Jonathan lectured on, I played with the small gold hi around my neck. Grandma B had given it to me for Hanukkah 3 years ago, a gift from her final trip to Israel. Jonathan kept blathering, so next I stared at the bronze menorah, wax-free and gleaming from its bath in the oven. My brother had intentionally filled it with red and green candles, Christmas colors.
And in 2013, the first night of Hanukkah will be November 27th, and the first day will be Thanksgiving.
To me, 2013 seemed like science fiction. I'd be 40. No.
You'll be 53 and I'll be 56. Mom and Dad?
He drew a finger across his throat.
Dad.
I beg your pardon.
Father replied.
I'll be 80 and your mother will be a spry 76.
Jonathan snorted.
Who lives to be 80?
With that attitude, Mom said, maybe we should skip the presents tonight. Jonathan shrugged.
It's only book night.
On Hanukkah's first night, our presents were always clothes. The second, books. My parents saved the biggest gift for the last night. Or, Mom said, I could just give Emma her book and leave you to consider the fifth commandment. Remember that one? Honor thy father and mother. That got him. Not the honoring our parents part, just the idea that I'd get a present and he wouldn't.
I'm so sorry,
Jonathan pleaded, but his tone was more theater than apology. My mother relented, dramatically handing us our gifts, putting on a show of her own, but her feelings were obviously hurt. Didn't Jonathan remember Mom's own mother, Grandma B, had died in December, just 2 years ago? Some genius he was. It wasn't until the second chapter of Island of the Blue Dolphins, personally I loved book night, that I remembered the paper in my pocket. I examined it under my desk lamp. God. If I had liked Bobby Benson, or if he had written God's name in fancy calligraphy, I might have kept it, at least for a while. But God was just three awkward letters, smudged pencil on creased paper, oafish, ungainly. When I'd taken it from Nurit, discarding the paper had seemed simple. Jewish law says to bury anything with God's name. Worn-out prayer books, tattered mezuzahs, scrolls, and especially Torahs. But as I pinned the paper to my bulletin board, I wondered what to bury it in. What is the proper coffin for God? Under my blankets, I thought about coffins and being dead, being endlessly dead, perpetuity. I hated imagining either of my parents gone forever, even in 2013, a year a million miles away. Death scared me, but I was too old to run to my parents for comfort. Instead, I envisioned Grandma B, with her cable-knit sweaters and salt-and-pepper hair, how she had smelled like rose water and cold wool, how she read me bedtime stories, softly sang from Psalm 90, the bedtime prayer. The next night, my father chose the candles, red, yellow, and green, with white for the shamas, the helper candle.
Traffic light colors.
That didn't seem very holy to me, but our family rule was that no one complained about other people's candle choices. After dessert, I gave Jonathan the 45 single of In the Year 2525. He gave me a Flintstones bike bell, which made me wonder if I'd be getting that purple stingray bike I wanted. On Wednesday, our candles alternated red, orange, and yellow, Mom's autumn palette. Jonathan received a gold-plated mechanical pencil, and I unwrapped a set of 24 Prismacolor pencils. In counterpoint, a single stout white candle burned steadily on the far end of the table. Tonight was Grandma B's yahrzeit. After supper, I used my new pencils to draw Hanukkah cards for my father and mother. Tomorrow, my brother and I would give gifts to them. Jonathan gave Dad QB7 and the promise to Mom.
You can't go wrong with Chaim Potok,
my father had counseled when my brother had asked for his advice. Mom said the same thing about Leon Uris. I gave my parents, both enthusiastic gardeners,
vegetable seeds to start tomatoes, peppers, and squash in the sunroom. February is such a dreary time of year, Mom said, unwrapping a packet of peas. It lifts my heart to see green shoots. Peas and lettuce are for early planting, I told her, even though I knew she knew this. Those seeds go right in the ground. As Mom nodded, I remembered last night's yardside candle and wondered if she was thinking of Grandma B, buried in the cold earth. Buried. No more ignoring the God paper. From the back of my top dresser drawer, I dug out the small white box that had helped my Chai necklace. I folded the God paper and set it inside. Tomorrow I'd bury it in the vegetable garden, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, ephemeral, ethereal, ether. Except I envisioned Grandma B lying in the cemetery, death everlasting. Was Grandma lonely? At least, I comforted myself, she lay next to Grandpa Herschel. There was another name for God.
El Echad.
The One. Strange for someone with a dozen names, and also sad. Would God's name be lonely, buried in our vegetable garden? I imagined
Hashem
underground for years and years, long after I grew up and moved away. What could keep God company in the small white box? I considered the tiniest occupants of my room, the glass cat with the chipped ear, my Grandma Moses postage stamp canceled, my Apollo 8 postage stamp uncanceled. Nothing seemed right. Thursday was my night to choose candles. Blue, yellow, blue, yellow, blue, with a yellow shamus. As we blessed them, another of God's names rose to mind.
El Olam.
The world. The universe. Even, my teacher had said, infinity or eternity. Perpetual.
In 1978,
Jonathan announced, even before Mom sat down,
the last day of Hanukkah will be New Year's.
Another topic, shall we? Mom intervened. Emma, what would you like to discuss? I thought for a moment, then asked her, how do you spell God?
G-O-D, dummy.
I don't mean like that. How do you write it so you can throw out the paper? G-D or G-D? Or do you use that little star?
It's called an asterisk.
My father sent Jonathan a scowling look.
I don't think it matters in English. Though, come to think of it, the Temple Bulletin uses G-D. Why do you ask?
We're learning about God's names in Hebrew school. Dad sliced a piece of flank steak. He looked thoughtful as he chewed.
Way to kill the conversation, Jonathan whispered.
I didn't mind. I looked at the candles. They reminded me of sky and stars, how our sun was a star. I had thought the shamus was the least important candle, but maybe it was the most. Without it, the other candles couldn't shine. Maybe God is the shamus.
Or.
The Hebrew word for light. Is or one of God's names, I asked. The light?
You're certainly a philosopher tonight.
Mom began clearing our dishes. My mother, she said, wrote it with a little star. The next day I searched the world for something, the right thing to put in the box with God. Flower petals would shrivel. A spider would die. Pine needles? Too much like a Christmas tree. A yarmulke wouldn't fit, and a loose thread plucked from my father's talus. Well, there were no loose threads, I tried. Half a Hanukkah candle? A clove from our spice box. Ashes? Dust? Then I remembered
Elohim.
Mighty ones. Plural. God needs God. At my desk, on my best stationery, in my best handwriting, I wrote, God, 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 and folded it into fourths. I set my gods on top of Baruch's God and taped the box shut. As I walked behind our house, trowel in one hand, the box in the other, I smelled chicken baking and latkes frying. Soon we would light the Hanukkah and Sabbath candles. I hurried to the garden where next spring's sorrel, leeks, and walking onions lay resting, perennials. The soil was cold, but not too hard. I began to dig. There are Hebrew blessings you recite when you hear a thunder, feel an earthquake, or see lightning, a comet, or a rainbow. There's even a blessing for strange-looking animals. But what do you recite when you bury God's name between rhubarb and strawberries, when you cover God with a blanket of dirt? In my mind, I smelled rose water and cold wool. Grandma B. Now I knew what to say, the bedtime prayer. With my wing I cover you, under my wings take refuge. You will not know the fright of the night, because you know my name.
How to Spell the Name of God by Eleanor Leans. She won the Lambda Literary Award for The Butches of Madison County, and she writes books about lesbian and gay humor. Our next story, Of Love and Latkes, was written by Leah Pripstein.
Ava met Yaakov on bingo night at Beth Israel Senior Center. She helped him find the words on the board, and they got to talking. Yaakov had lost his wife, Clara, a few months before. Ava had been a widow for 5 years. They discovered they were both from the same region in the Ukraine and had lived in Brooklyn for about the same length of time.
Yaakov had food stains on his shirt and old tissues stuffed in his pocket, but what really got to Ava was a pitiful margarine sandwich Yaakov extracted from the inside of his jacket. She asked if he'd like to come over for dinner, and he said yes.
It was good to have someone to cook for again. With Sam, her late husband, they had such wonderful meals. Cooking had always been a passion, but cooking for Sam was especially satisfying, as no one was more appreciative of her creations than he. He smacked his lips and licked his fingers, declaring her the best cook in all of Brooklyn, or possibly even the whole of New York. Now, stirring plump fricadellin in golden broth, Ava imagined Yaakov's exultations, and her heart expanded.
Yaakov arrived with a bouquet of flowers. He was full of compliments for her apartment, how clean it was, how tastefully arranged. He examined the photographs of her grown grandchildren, pronouncing them handsome and bright. He was helpful, too, setting the table while she ladled the soup into bowls.
She watched him take a spoonful, then another, gulping the soup down with eagerness that suggested it pleased him. But he was oddly silent. No exclamations of delight or words of appreciation. How is it? She asked.
He nodded. Thank you very much.
She served the main course, chicken breast with a side of rice and a nice green salad, all to the same effect. Yaakov consumed his portion with relish, but said little more than thank you in response.
After dinner, he told her about his childhood as a son of party activists, how at a very young age he had learned to take care of the house, cleaning and cooking, mostly noodles, in time for his parents' return.
You poor thing, Ava said, recording the homemade delicacies her mother had put out for her.
Yaakov smiled at that. Sometimes I thought so too. Other times I didn't mind so much.
They made tea, and Ava served dessert. I hope you like jam rolls, she said. My mother's recipe.
Thank you, was all he gave her. Thank you for inviting me, he said, when it was time to go.
Would you like to come again Tuesday, she asked. I'll make borscht.
So it went for several weeks. Chicken soup, meat patties, pierogi with mushrooms and leeks, olfactory memories of life past permeating her apartment.
It's been so long since I've done real cooking, she said to Yaakov over a plate of pelmeni. It's not fun to cook just for yourself.
You can cook for me anytime, he declared. She waited for him to say more, praise the quality of the food and her skill as a cook. He didn't, but nodded enthusiastically when she asked if he'd like some more.
She wondered why he was so tight-lipped when it came to her cooking. He seemed quite capable of complimenting her on everything else. For someone who'd grown up on noodles, he turned out to be exceptionally hard to please.
Thanksgiving they spent at their children's. Seizing a quiet moment alone with her daughter, Ava confided her fears.
What if I'm not as good a cook as I thought I was? Who knows what he was used to with Clara?
It's not the Middle Ages, Mama. There's more to relationships than food.
Ava frowned. Of course, food wasn't everything, but it wasn't nothing either. These days, women thought they could get away with takeout and frozen. What they failed to understand was that a home-cooked meal was more than nourishment. It was family and belonging, a taste of childhood, a kind of love. She didn't say any of that to her daughter. Instead, she said, "I want my efforts to be appreciated. Is that so bad?"
"Why don't you just ask him outright what he thinks of your cooking," her daughter said. Or if you must, ask him if you cook as well as his wife."
"Are you mad?" Ava gasped. "I could never. I'll just have to try harder, that's all." She came home determined. If everyday meals didn't do the trick, surely her specials would. Upon his return, Yakov was treated to her famed brisket and tzimis. Back in the day, this very dish had marked a turnaround in her relationship with her mother-in-law.
"You must love my son very much," the matron had said to Ava with tears in her eyes.
If she could melt her mother-in-law's heart, at the very least she should be able to elicit a word of acknowledgement from Yakov.
"Are you expecting company?" Yakov said when she uncovered the brisket.
"No, just you."
"Well, this is... Thank you, Ava." He devoured his portion and nodded when she offered more.
"Good?"
"Mmm." He shoved another forkful into his mouth. "Thank you."
Why won't he just say the word? "They didn't feed you at your son's house?" she asked.
He seemed not to notice her sarcasm.
"My daughter-in-law doesn't cook," he explained, and then added with a chuckle, "They say I've gained weight since they last saw me."
So now her food was too fattening? "Did Clara cook low-fat?" she inquired, more than a little peeved.
His expression changed. "No," he said, so miserable she regretted saying anything.
"Eat, eat," she added tzimis to his plate. "If it's any consolation, I think you look good."
He smiled. "Not as good as you."
She wondered if her daughter was right. She enjoyed his company, and he enjoyed hers. Wasn't that enough? But when she tried to let go of it, it wouldn't let go of her. His refusal to utter anything more than and thank you felt unnatural, as if he was stopping himself from saying something he would regret.
For days, she agonized over her options. At last, she had an idea.
"Why don't I cook for you at your place this Friday night?" she said to him. The things Ava could not ask would be revealed once she stepped into Clara's kitchen. A woman's culinary interest, her skill, manifested itself in her workspace, and who better than Ava to pick up on those subtle indicators?
Yakov seemed reluctant at first. Ava would find it uncomfortable, the kitchen hasn't been used in a while. Ava dismissed his excuses. A change in scenery would do them both good, she said, and handed him a list of ingredients.
She brought her set of knives and condiments, and it immediately became apparent she shouldn't have bothered. The kitchen was small, but surprisingly well equipped. Blenders, pressers, crushers, an assortment of spices she didn't know the names for, and a long shelf of cookbooks from Bulgarian to Southern French. The ingredients she had asked Yakov to buy awaited her on the counter. How plain her planned dinner seemed compared to the grand meals tucked in those pages. It took all of Ava's strength to put her apron on and start chopping, each turn of the knife making her wince.
It didn't help that Yakov kept pressing Clara's fancy tools on her. "See this? It slices the egg just so. And this is for pitting olives."
"I'll do it my way, thank you very much." She wished she could shoo him out of the kitchen, but this was his home, his and Clara's. At no time since she'd met Yakov did she feel so out of place.
They lit the Shabbat candles and sat down to eat with a photograph of Clara overseeing their dinner. Clara's pleasant face wore a sad little smile, as if, despite her best efforts, things hadn't turned out quite as she'd hoped.
Ava knew exactly how that felt. She hardly touched the veal and cauliflower. Long ago, this very dish had her daughter's boyfriend returning until he'd finally proposed. Now it tasted of caustic embarrassment.
"You're not hungry?" Yakov asked with a mouthful of food.
"No."
"You've tired yourself out with all that cooking," he said. "Why don't you rest on the couch?"
She complied, letting him take off her shoes and place her feet in his lap.
"I used to do that for Clara when she got anxious," he said, massaging her heel.
His hands felt good, but Ava could not enjoy them. "I was wrong to come," she said. "This dinner, it must remind you of Clara."
"Remind me? No. With Clara, it was different." He glanced sadly at his unfinished plate. "Completely different."
That was it, then, the terrible truth. No matter how she tried, she would always come short. His eagerness that she'd mistaken for satisfaction was nothing more than a rush to be done with her food. And she, the fool that she was, kept offering him second helpings. She got up from the couch. "I should go," she said, grabbing her coat and purse.
He seemed surprised, but didn't try to stop her. I'll walk you home," he offered.
"Please don't. I'll be fine." December wind chilled her all the way home, but she hardly noticed. Her body was frozen in shame for her arrogance and stupidity. She had assumed she was giving him something of value, when in truth it was an ordeal for him. He might have thought he was sparing her feelings by keeping silent, but he just made it worse.
He called the next morning. She didn't pick up. The day after, he left 3 messages. The last one sounded quite desperate. "Call me, please."
She called him.
"Thank God," he said. "I was about to send in a search party."
"No need. I'm fine."
There was an awkward silence. Then he said, "Tomorrow is the first night of Hanukkah. I thought we could light candles, eat some latkes. And not that I want you to cook. God knows you've cooked enough. They sell frozen latkes at the..."
"I can make latkes, Yakov," she cut him off.
"Of course you can," he agreed. "Should we say 5 o'clock?
5 is fine," she hung up, fuming. Latkes he wanted to spare her. Latkes that she could whip up with her eyes closed and both hands tied behind her back. Oh, the wonderful latkes she used to make for Sam. Potato and leek, sweet potato and raisin, zucchini patties, and bite-sized fried salmon balls. Her husband never had to eat the same latke twice.
But no sooner had she recalled her past achievements than her gloom returned. No matter what she did, the memory of Clara's cooking would always hover over Yaakov and her like a bitter aftertaste. If only she could care less, put a little less soul into her cooking. But that was like asking her to love with less heart.
She went to bed on an empty stomach. In her dreams, Clara was serving her latkes, golden and fluffy like Ava's mother used to make. She awoke sore and morose. By midday, when the time came to start frying, she was perfectly despondent. She had cut herself twice on the grater, something she hadn't done since she'd learned how to grate. She had poured too much oil, and it hissed and spit, covering her bare arms with tiny burns. She recalled how long ago, when her teenage daughter rejected her cooking, her husband had tried to console her.
"Sometimes love is knowing what's needed, not giving all you can give," he had said. She was mad at him for saying that, as if she didn't know her own child. But he was right. She wanted to make her daughter happy her way, just as she did with Yaakov.
When Yaakov showed up, he found the apartment smoky and Ava in tears.
"What happened? Did you hurt yourself?"
She pointed at a pile of black-bottomed latkes. "I was a fool, trying to impress you with my cooking, when in truth I'm quite mediocre, certainly not as good as your Clara."
He stared at her, speechless, then burst out laughing, so hard she feared he might break a rib. "Oh, God, Ava, I miss Clara. I do, but her cooking?" He picked up a scorched latke. "This is the closest you ever got to Clara's cooking. Clara was a wonderful, sensitive person, but a terrible, terrible cook."
"But all those cookbooks, the tools."
"She kept trying, hoping it would make a difference. It didn't. It was her biggest disappointment."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I didn't know I needed to. Clara was so insecure about her cooking, even compliments made her cry. I learned to say, thank you, and nothing more." He took Ava's hand and kissed the inside of her palm. "I loved every single thing you made for me."
Ava cupped his face in her hands and kissed him for the longest time. Tomorrow, she would make spicy squash latkes to go with the second candle. She had so much more to give.
Erev Christmas by Clement Clark Moore, translated by Marie B. Jaffe.
Siz gewen Erev Christmas und still is in Heisel, kein Nefesh riert sich, a fille kein Meisel. Beim Euvele seinen die Socken gehangen, mit Hoffnung, als bald wird der Junter von fangen. Die Kinderlach liegen verdeckt in die Bettlach und süße Choläum ist bei sie tanzen in Kepplach. Die Weib in Fatschele und ich in mein Jammerke haben sich zugelegt, hoppen nach Dremel. Dann plötzlich in Dreußen, a Gewalt, a Geridder, ich spring von mein Bett mit zerreißelte Glieder. Ich flieh wie a Wind, ich läufe versammter, komm, komm, bin ich da, und ich öffne a Fenster. Der Schnee hat gefallen, a weißer, a neier, und es scheint die Lewonne mit herrlichen Feier. Ich guck mit Überraschung, ich seh, oi, weiß mir, a kleinschicke Droschke mit 8 kleine Reindeer. Ein altinker Treiber, aber freilich, geschickt. Ich hab bald verstanden, muss sein Rebnik. Viel schneller wie Vögel die Hirschelach kommen. Pfeift und schreit und ruft sie bei Namen.
Komm, Dascher, komm, Pranzer, komm, Danzer und Wichsen, komm, Comet, komm, Cupid, komm, Donder und Blitzen. Ruf auf den Porch, jetzt kriecht auf die Wand. Kommt, riert sich, Haverem, soll sein mit Verstand.
A See wie vertrickende Blätter sich heben, wenn's bloß darf sie sturmige Winden von eben. A See ist die Droschke gepflegen zum Dach, mit allerlei guttinke Sachen gepackt. Nur a halbe Minutke in ganzen verhappen und mein Herd auf dem Dach wie die Fisselach klappen. Ich dreh sich herum und komm mach ich a Stell, ot steht der Rebnicki bei mir auf dem Schwell. Ausgeputzt in a Futter, was passt ihm sehr wehl. A bissl schmutzig mit Asch und mit Kehl schleppt a Säckel mit Zatzkelach voll Kennenare. Guckt euch wie a Peddler, was handelt mit Ware. Sein Egelach blistchen, sein Punemel finkelt, die Bäckelach reit und der Nesel a pinkel. Die Mäul is a kleine, doch sehr sympathisch und sein schneeweißer Bord tacke ganz balabatisch. Rächert a Lulke zwischen die Zehen und der Reich fließt darum seinen Kopf gerade schön. Ot gitt a Lach und sein rundiger Beichel zu schockelt sich punkt wie a Teller mit Meichel. A wohlenker Menschele, gut ausgepaschet, ich hab sich zu lacht, hat mir nicht gestraschet. A Wunk mit sein Egg und sein Kopf geht a Dreh, man kann sich vorstellen, als is okay. Redt nicht a Wort, seine Arbeit hat das, hat alle mens Socken gestoppt on a Moss. Gepattert sein Arbeit, dann geht a Lach und hebt sich a Reus sehr schnell durch dem Dach. Springt er rein in sein Droschke, on Stiegen, on Leiter, geht er pfeift zu die Hirschen, und fahren sie weiter. Doch hör ich a Stimme, wo singt auf den Wind,
Gut Jontif mich boche, und seid's mir gesinnt!
And that's it for the 2021 edition of Hanukkah Lights.
Our show was produced by Saraya Muhammad and Fiona O'Reilly.
Anya Grundman is the Senior Vice President for Programming and Audience Development.
Our music is by Jorah Feidman.
To hear these stories again, plus earlier Hanukkah Lights programs, please visit our website, npr.org.
We wish you a wonderful holiday filled with blessings and light. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg.
Happy Hanukkah!